This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha.
Yeah, it is about money.
And how heavy this work is. Mm-hmm. Frontline workers and like counselors, social workers, you know, they're having to navigate working with kids who have been traumatized and working with these families as well who have been traumatized and trying to keep kids together. And
everyone I talk to wants to provide more mental health services.
In Missouri, there's a gap in foster care. While residential facilities with specialized staff have enough beds for boys, there's a shortage of such space available for girls. Chris Husted, investigative editor for the NPR Midwest Newsroom, recently explored what's behind that disparity, and he joins us now to talk about it. Chris, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you, Elaine, for having me.
So, Chris, in your piece, you wrote that qualified residential treatment programs collectively have about 200 beds specifically designated for boys, but only about 60 for girls. Why is that the case?
Yeah, it's only been noticeable for the last 2 years, too. But the biggest reason is that we've found a collective more contemporary understanding of trauma that girls go through. So these QRTPs, it's a fancy name for a really specialized group home for in the foster care system. And the attention and care that girls have in these specific homes are incredibly individualized in response to the different traumas that these girls have faced in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand a little bit more about the science and why girls experience things a little differently. There's also an elevated level of trauma that happens because girls are obviously higher at risk for sexual assault and abuse, which triggers a lot of trauma, of course.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, what kind of care are we talking about? And what are the, you talked a little bit about the specialized needs that the facilities character or that they cater to, but what is the care that they're receiving there?
Yeah, so they receive care from there's psychiatrists at these facilities, there's therapists at these facilities, the staff there's a 24-hour nurse, clinicians. It's a lot of specialized staff who have experience and training in caring for girls specifically who have experienced some of these traumas, have PTSD, have things that boys don't always necessarily experience at a higher rate, like say eating disorders. That girls just generally have need that individualized care when they reach this level,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have a foster parent or a kin to be placed with to go through this treatment. These are the girls that this is sort of the last stop where the staff is able to help address some of those issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, Enola Martin is someone you spoke with for this reporting. What was Enola's experience specifically at Missouri Girlstown like?
Right. Enola entered the foster system when she was 11 years old. She has several siblings as well, and they had not a great experience with their father or their mother. There's drug addiction and substance abuse and living in random places that weren't necessarily in a home. So she entered the foster system at 11. She was actually adopted at 14, but her adopted mother had some challenges with Enola as a teenager, and Enola herself says she was rebellious, she was sneaking out, essentially was placed in Missouri Girlstown to address some of her behavioral issues.
Mm-hmm.
While she was there, she fellowshipped with some of the other girls, she had treatment, she had a regimented routine, a structure to her day, which included schooling and classes on money management, things that we don't always get in schools,
right.
Something that she very values today. Also, in addition to seeing therapists and working on her behavioral issues. And she was there for about 2 years before she left.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like overall, it was a positive experience for Enola to be in that kind of environment.
She said one bed, one open bed changed her life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the issue that we've run into in reporting the story is there aren't enough beds out there for this safety net that is quite necessary.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that your reporting, Chris, highlighted was the results of a Stanford University study, and that looked at how boys and girls experience PTSD in particular differently. Now, how does that study relate to these treatment centers we're discussing, and perhaps to the disparities that we're seeing with the number of beds that are available to girls?
Yeah, so that study talks about how, you know, the brain processes things a little differently when girls experience trauma versus when boys do. And to have that training to see how that manifests in girls is really important. I'm not particularly, you know, a psychiatrist or expert in how that is treated, mm-hmm. but I do know that in talking to the providers who do this care, they say it is a lot more challenging. The acuity and that, you know, is that these girls have, which is it's just really heightened right now when they see these girls at this level, meaning they are very sensitive to lots of different types of stresses. And they also need the constant monitoring or care because of some of the mental health challenges and behavioral disorders that they have developed, maybe in response to some of the stress. Mm-hmm. The providers say it does cost more to care for girls than it does to care for boys, mm-hmm. which is something I hadn't even considered when reporting on the shortage of girls' beds.
Right. Now, as far as trauma responses go, one of the responses can be violence. And so we've talked about the foster care system, that's child welfare. But when it comes to girls in the foster system who are, you know, at these residential facilities with specialized services, I mean, that is not the only place they may get sent, right?
Yeah, if, you know, in severe situations when the girl has maybe violent outbursts or a really aggressive behavior or actually commits a crime, then there's then she gets placed likely in the juvenile justice system, mm-hmm. which, as you know, one can assume and research shows, that's a challenge in its own, especially when that girl needs maybe a little more care. And I will say that in the juvenile justice system, there are places and moments where she can get that type of care, but it's not also, you know, easily out there, and there's plenty of space and trained professionals to help with that. Mm-hmm. So it is a challenge there as well. And all of the moving through the juvenile justice system or even within the child welfare system poses its own challenges because of the different outcomes that happen when you're moving this child around so many places. Mm-hmm. The Families First Services Act that came out in 2018 really, I'm taking a step back here, just really tried to prevent kids entering the foster system, but or if they had to, the goal is to move them in as few places as possible, because mm-hmm. that disruption can create worst outcomes, negative outcomes for that girl.
Right.
So when there isn't a bed space and she gets sent, maybe because of issues with her behavior, to the juvenile justice system or to out-of-state location, that poses its own challenges for outcomes.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the juvenile justice system, one of the sources you spoke with mentioned how girls who display violence can be responded to differently than boys would be. I mean, and is it then that violence that affects staffing levels at these facilities too?
It does. It does. One thing you mentioned there that I didn't really get to in the report too much is how we treat girls differently than boys, and that's kind of a societal thing. But to discuss the staffing issues, you're asking these highly trained staff to also take on a heavy load working with these girls who have a lot of who have a lot of trauma and have maybe have violent outbursts or behavioral disorders where they may say things and yell, and that kind of can take a toll on the staff itself, which in turn makes it challenging to pay someone to come help work with these girls,
right,
if you don't, you know, have that passion, which a lot of the staff do have, and the providers I talk to point to the passion as a reason why they stick around, even though the providers would like to pay the staff more. That comes into play with how much the state reimburses these providers for the space for the girls.
Mm-hmm. So is it then primarily about money and there not being enough for those who have the willingness to work but also deserve to be paid, you know, what they're worth.
Yeah, it is about money. One of the providers I talked to in Iowa said, you know, I will also say that Missouri and Iowa, both legislatures have increased rates, and that's how this happens. And this is like Medicaid reimbursements. But also a lot of these providers depend on donations and fundraising for their operations.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were able to get more reimbursement from the state, that would help them pay their employees better, also help them provide more services. And mm-hmm. everyone I talk to wants to provide more mental health services. They've got what they can do right now, but that doesn't mean that's going to be able to serve the next girl that needs a spot. So that's something that would help a lot. And the legislators have been responsive to that, but with inflation and everything kind of creeping up cost-wise, they still need more money to make these operations function at the level they want them to, and to grow the number of beds in the state.
Mm-hmm. Now, here in Missouri, the state has partnered with Home State Health, a subsidiary of managed health care company Centene, to launch a statewide single managed care plan called Show Me Healthy Kids for all of its foster youth in 2022. What does that do, Chris?
What part of that does is it provides a caseworker to work with the girl or the boy make sure that they are receiving the correct care that they need. It also helps them make the transition from leaving foster care system and continuing to receive services afterwards to make sure that the outcome is the strongest it could be for that child's situation. That case manager really helps identify the specific services that should be in place for the child that's leaving a group home setting and returning maybe to a foster home, or ultimately the goal is to be back with family.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent then, you know, we said that it started in 2022. Are we able to assess the effectiveness of the Show Me Healthy Kids program so far?
It's still fairly new. I will say that I talked with the state about Sarah Smith, who's the residential services director for the state, and they are part of the program is they actually get to receive data from the kids in the placement and seeing how things are working out, what the outcome is, and that's helping them inform and shape the foster system and the group home goals of how they can treat some of these children.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still fairly early, I think, but so far so good is how I would say it probably.
And so, you know, as we're talking about this, about children in the foster care system, I mean, in the U.S., between fiscal years 2018 and 2022, the number of children entering the foster system across the country declined by nearly 77,000 youth. So if there is less demand, why are we looking at this problem, what we started talking about, which is this gap between beds available for girls and boys?
It's a good question. And if you look at the breakdown of who is in the foster system, I think it's about 51% boys, 49% girls. Numbers are going down. And people will say anecdotally, that's likely because of the Family's First Act that really put an emphasis on preventative and keeping kids with a family member and doing services on the front end. But this back end, these group homes, they're a sort of a necessary situation for children that have these extraordinary needs,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that children are not going as into the foster system as they used to is a good sign, but it also, you know, there are the children that do need these services still. So without the funding and with the more recognition, particularly of what girls go through, we've talked about a little bit about how trauma manifests and the experiences that they have had, and again, primarily like sexual assault. These beds are expensive to keep up, and mm-hmm. it's hard for them to do that with the rates that they're getting, even though fewer kids are going into the foster system.
Right. Chris Husted is an investigative editor for the NPR Midwest Newsroom. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about this report.
Thank you for having me.
Chris's story on Missouri's lack of beds at group foster homes can be found on our website. That's stlpr.org. And joining me now is STLPR reporter Lucretia Wimbley, whose recent reporting brings light to the state of Missouri's foster care system. Lucretia, welcome back to the show. So we just heard from Chris about how on a national level, there are fewer children entering the foster care system. Does that mirror what's happening here in Missouri, Lucretia?
Absolutely. So at the end of 2021, there were about 14,000 kids in foster care here in Missouri. But as of last month, when I spoke with Missouri's children's director, Daryl Missy, he said that there are about 11,800 kids in the foster system now. So like Chris mentioned, that's encouraging news, which means that more kids are being adopted and fewer kids are lingering in the system. And of course, there are kids who age out of the system, too, that factors into that decline.
Right. Now, what did the people you spoke with say about what needs to happen in order for more children to receive the placement and protections they need if they are in the foster system?
Sure. So, again, like Chris kind of mentioned, and you guys were talking about at the end of the conversation there, retaining workers has been an issue due to pay and how heavy this work is. Frontline workers and counselors, social workers, they're having to navigate working with kids who have been traumatized and working with these families as well who have been traumatized and trying to keep kids together. And there are, of course, various initiatives and legislation that is, in the works and trying to be passed to help streamline this process and make it faster and also make sure the kids are receiving the adequate support and care. And so the problem that the state has run into with getting kids placed more quickly lies partially in a staffing problem, too. And Missouri's Department of Social Services released a report last year that pointed out two reasons the state's child welfare system, two issues that the state's child welfare system faces. And that's an inability to recruit and retain workers and a lack of staffing needed to operate what they're trying to build into a proactive and holistic child welfare system. But when I spoke with Missy last month, he said that they hired about 100 more workers recently. That's between this year and last year. And that includes, like I said, counselors, social workers, and other folks who are working directly with these families. But right now, there are about 2,000 workers within the state's Department of Children's Services here in Missouri.
So we're here in a bi-state region, and there's some peculiarities around that, depending where you are in the state. Can you talk with us about the challenges there are in placing kids with family who live across state line? There's some differences, right, between where you are in the state of Missouri.
Sure, absolutely. So Missouri's Department of Children's Services has to work through something called the Interstate Compact on the Placement of Children, also known by its acronym ICPC. But this is essentially a legally binding contract between member states, Congress, and U.S. territories. And so under this law, that means the state cannot place a child across state lines without permission from other states, essentially. And being granted permission to place a child across state lines can be a lengthy process that can take months, mainly because other states have a whole bunch of time to pretty much vet and check out the placement options recommended by other states. And essentially, the purpose of ICPC is to ensure that the states are effectively working together to ensure that the children who are placed across state lines for adoption or foster care, that they receive the best support and protection services.
Right. And in places like Kansas, it's easier, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so it's a smoother process for placing children in Kansas, mainly because there's an agreement that Missouri has with the state of Kansas, essentially providing that they can bypass this lengthy ICPC process and not have to wait for months to get a child placed. They can essentially, Missouri Children's Division workers can essentially go over into Kansas and Kansas City and, begin working with frontline workers in their Department of Children's Services to get kids placed without having to wait for them to vet it themselves.
Right. What are some of the efforts that are happening here in the St. Louis area efforts to recruit Black families in particular to sign up to be foster parents.
Yeah. So there's an organization or a program called Respond, and it was first founded in the late 80s by an African-American couple. Their names are Howard and Vicki Denson. Mm-hmm. And the program was closed in the early 2000s, but it was reopened or revamped in 2022 by the Foster and Adoptive Care Coalition here in Missouri.
Right.
And so essentially the program's purpose is to inform Black people about the processes and of fostering and adopting here in Missouri. And the program recruits Black people to become foster parents. And the reason, when I spoke with Howard and Vicki, they pointed out that there was a need for this because around 70% of foster kids are Black here in St. Louis, and mm-hmm. only 13% of foster parents are African American. And so there's quite a discrepancy there.
Mm-hmm. And we talked actually about that program about a year or so mm-hmm. ago. Now, in our last minute, you spoke with Tricia Gordon, who shared what it was like to grow up in the foster care system. In these last, 60 seconds or so, what's one piece of wisdom or a major takeaway that she shared with you about what needs to happen to improve outcomes for kids?
Sure. Tricia currently works for the Foster and Adoptive Care Coalition, and she has her own testimony of going through the foster care system herself here in Missouri. But one piece of advice that she provided for current foster youth, or really she provided the advice for any youth in general, and I think adults can take from this too, but that is to, accept the challenge and ensure that you are doing all that you can to live your life and, not allow the challenges of life, your foster care experience, to stop you from being successful and doing what you love to do.
Lucretia Wimbley is a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Her story in the state of Missouri's foster care system can be found at our website, stlpr.org.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.